And that's what we're going to talk about today, how to get to Sesame Street. Jim Henson's sudden death in 1990 foreshadowed turbulent times on Sesame Street. The landmark children's show faced competition from a new generation of children's programming and a purple dinosaur named Barney. Now, in a new book, Michael Davis recalls Sesame Street's creation and the challenges it's faced and faces today after almost 40 years on television. The book is titled Street Gang. Michael Davis joins me. He was a senior editor and columnist at TV Guide magazine for 9 years. He's also worked for the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, and Chicago Sun-Times. If you'd like to join us, you many, many fans of Sesame Street, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Michael Davis.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to have you here.
Thanks so much. What a pleasure for me.
Thank you. You begin the book with Jim Henson's death. That could have been the end of the show.
It could have been. Yes, at the beginning of the book, I take you to an extraordinary memorial service for Jim, open to the public. And it was a sort of a collision of all the worlds of Jim Henson, the first time and only time that it ever happened. Sesame Street and the Muppet Show people and his films. And Jim had written his children 5 years earlier to say to them that on the day that he passed, he did not want a funeral in the classic sense. He wanted to have a celebration of life, and he asked that no one wear black. And so everyone abided by his wishes, and one of his puppeteers wore a Kermit green suit.
Do you think he had some kind of premonition? There's been some talk about that.
Yes. I mean, I don't believe so. I just think he was a very planful man in writing those letters to his children. I don't think he presaged his death. But there are people who believe that he did, who believe that he wasn't going to see his grandchildren and that he'd die at 53.
He had a curious death.
He did. He did, and a senseless death, in my estimation. Jim was not one to go to see doctors, and he had a streptococcal infection and had it for many weeks, and it became one of those rampaging infections, and by the time he did get to the hospital, his organs were already shutting down. A timely visit to the hospital for a doctor, even maybe 12 hours earlier, he would have saved his own life.
That's really extraordinary.
Yes, and so sad.
So sad. How important were his Muppets to Sesame Street?
Critically important. And for many reasons, not just artistically, and not because, you know, they gave the show its signature sense of humor, but the revenue that came in from the licensing and merchandising of those characters kept Children's Television Workshop, which it was called back then, it's called Sesame Workshop now, kept them afloat and also kept the Jim Henson Company afloat. Without that money, he would not have been able to make the movies that he did and do the vanity projects that he loved so much.
So you had, right from the start with the introduction of those Muppets, the idea that you could have kind of a circular revenue flow.
I don't know if he did, but he was smart enough to say when he was negotiating with Joan Ganz Cooney, don't pay me very much for my first year of work. I just want to hold on to the trademark of these characters.
Interesting. How did the idea of Sesame Street come about?
It came about at a dinner party held at the home of Tim and Joan Cooney back in 1965. After dinner, Lloyd Morissette, a very smart experimental psychologist who was working for the Carnegie Foundation, just asked a question aloud. He said, do you think television could do more than merely entertain children? Do you think it could teach? And Joan immediately picked up on that. At that time in her life, she was a producer at WNET in New York of public service programming and documentaries, and had done a documentary a few years earlier about a program in Harlem. And the special was called A Chance at the Beginning. And it was about this incredible program, successful program in Harlem, where they were giving intensive instruction to preschool children. Huh. And it was having such great results for those children as they entered school life that that program became a model for what became Head Start. So Joan did essentially the first documentary about what became Head Start. So she already had this built-in interest in preschoolers.
And that interest in preschoolers and what they were capable of learning through the medium of television.
Yes, Diane. And, you know, I take readers back to that age of the nursery school, back to the 1950s. And we expected so little of preschoolers back then. We really didn't challenge them very much. And, you know, I'm a child of the 50s, I remember. And right around the time that Sesame Street was born, there was a revolution underway, you know, in what we could teach preschool children, how we could teach them. And sort of Sesame Street came at just the right moment in cultural history.
You know, even children in the crib. I mean, all of that came about in the early 60s. The idea of putting
mobiles
into the crib, the idea of playful toys into the crib that would teach, not just be chewed on.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, some of it has to do with sociological history. You know, more women were in the workplace and later in the 60s. Therefore, there was more need for preschools and for daycare.
And, of course, then you had President Johnson taking up the cause of educational television.
How about it? We should give him credit for Sesame Street, too, because not only did he help to create the Corporation for Public Broadcasting during his administration, but there was a concerted effort to spend more money on preschool children. And let's see if we can't help them. Let's find a way. And certainly let's make sure that they get a meal early in the day so they don't arrive at school hungry, which is such a basic
part of his Great Society program.
Yes.
Michael Davis. His new book is titled Street Gang, The Complete Story of Sesame Street. And in it are not only the story, but all these wonderful photographs of the people and the puppets involved in this really evolution of children's programming. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I was fascinated to learn that the show was really sort of styled after Laugh-In with its quick pace.
It was. Joan famously said, I want a Laugh-In for children. And those in your audience who remember that show, it was a comedy cavalcade, a laugh a minute that included all kinds of comedy, blackouts, sketch comedy, knock-knock jokes, the whole range of comedy. And it's no accident that Sesame Street helped to create several generations now of children who are comedy literate.
Huh.
The show, just as Laugh-In had that whole range of what comedy can be, it was reflected in Sesame Street.
So that's what's wrong with me. I kind of missed that.
Yes.
You know, I think you're absolutely right that kids today have such a much sharper sense of comedy.
They do. And they recognize its forms, and Sesame Street plays a role in that.
Yeah.
I mean, what are Bert and Ernie if not a great comedy duo?
What was there before Bert and Ernie?
Abbott and Costello, you know, Burns and Allen. But Jim Henson and John Stone, the executive producer of Sesame Street, who gave it its soul. In Hebrew, it's neshama. He gave it its soul. Both of those guys were such huge fans of radio comedy, and it was in their DNA. And they made sure that some of the elements of what radio comedy, what made radio comedy work, spilled over into Sesame Street. In fact, if you watch early tape of the show and turn your back to the set, the comedy works. You don't have to see Bert and Ernie to appreciate the humor, because they wrote for the ear as well as for the eye.
And the eye was simply that magical addition of all those bright colors and quick movements and yet a certain gentleness along with it.
Oh, yes. The show, you know, this may be a bit of an exaggeration, but I really believe that Sesame Street helped to usher in the era of Obama. I do.
Street Gang. That's the title of Michael Davis's new book. Stay with us. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Michael Davis, who wrote for many years for TV Guide magazine. He's also worked for the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, Chicago Sun-Times. But he had probably the most fun writing this book. It's titled Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. And your email, please, to drshow@wamu.org. There were earlier children's programs. Talk about some of them.
Yeah, I take the reader back to the age of Ding Dong School, which was really the first attempt to reach a preschool audience with Miss Frances. Some of your listeners may remember that. And she got caught in a little bit of a trap. She became a commercial spokesperson for several products, and she delivered messages herself.
Oh, my.
And it was the first instance where people kind of stood up and said, I'm not so sure this is the right thing to do for preschool children.
Yeah.
And of course, it's happened many times since. So what the great thing in researching this book is that the founding fathers of Sesame Street, the three founding producers, all cut their teeth working with Bob Keeshan on Captain Kangaroo.
Captain Kangaroo.
Yes. And I want to say that Captain Kangaroo, Bob Keeshan, had the best interests of children at heart. He was an extraordinary performer and put on an extraordinary show for a great long period of time.
And what about Kukla, Fran, and Ollie?
Yeah, I take readers there, too, because Kukla, Fran, and Ollie really explored what television could do with puppetry. And Jim Henson, living in the Washington area as a teen and as a younger boy, watched Kukla, Fran, and Ali faithfully. And he always said that Burr Tillstrom had a major effect on his entire career. Mm-hmm.
Michael, wasn't the original plan to keep the human beings separate from the puppets?
Yes. When they had the original curriculum seminars for Sesame Street, they were at Harvard and in New York, the researchers said, you know, you should not commingle fantasy with reality. Have your puppets, but have them live in a different universe from the live-action cast. Well, what happened was they made pilot shows, and those segments on the street bombed with preschoolers. Mm. It wasn't until they sat in a room and said, how are we going to make these scenes work, that in came Jim Henson with the idea of having this 7-8 foot bird and this grouchy puppet that would come out of a trash can. And once children saw that in little focus groups, that's when the magic began to happen.
But then the people got involved, and certainly Mr. Hooper was one of the key people.
Yes. You know, you have to give them a lot of credit for having an older person in the cast. And, you know, Mr. Hooper is a projection of that that older Jewish man in New York who ran the little candy store with the soda fountain. And
it wasn't just in New York. There was a drugstore on our corner, a little delicatessen.
Yes.
Wonderful places.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he wore a white apron, and there was a pile of newspapers outside his store. And he, that grandfather figure, was very important to Sesame Street. And when Mr. Hooper died, it created a teachable moment that was extraordinary in the history of Sesame Street. He died suddenly, and they could have recast Mr. Hooper. They could have said he moved to Florida to be with his sister, but instead they decided to create a show that would attempt to explain death to preschoolers. And they did it in an informed way. They brought in researchers and clergymen and sensitive people from all corners to sit with the writing staff to try to explain to them and give them some ideas on how you could do this in sort of non-denominational way, but get across the message. At Sesame Workshop, they call that a curriculum bath. And so the writers were immersed into that bath, and they came up with an extraordinary script that was shown on a Thanksgiving day. And it still retains such power when you see it on YouTube.
Do you want to read this?
Okay. Here is the actual script. Big Bird says, he's got drawings that he's going to give to his friends on Sesame Street. He says, hey, it's time for your presents. I've just drawn up pictures of all my grown-up friends on Sesame Street, and I'm going to give them to you. I'm going to be an artist when I grow up. The drawings are passed around and admired. And last but not least, ta-da! He shows everyone a drawing of Mr. Hooper in half glasses and bow tie. Well, I can't wait till he sees it, Big Bird says. And there's an awkward silence and glances all around. Say, where is he? I want to give it to him. I know, he's in the store. And Bob says, Big Bird, he's not in there. And Big Bird says, then where is he? And Maria says, looking around and then talking directly to Big Bird, Big Bird, don't you remember we told you Mr. Hooper died? He's dead. And Big Bird said, oh, yeah, I remember. Well, I'll give it to him when he comes back. And Susan says, Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back. And Big Bird says, why not? And Susan says, soothing Big Bird's feathers, Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back. And Big Bird sorrowfully says, ever? And Susan says, no, never. And Big Bird says, well, why not? And Louise says, well, Big Bird, they're dead. They can't come back. And Big Bird, trying to comprehend, says, well, He's got to come back. Who's going to take care of the store? Who's going to make my birdseed milkshakes and tell me stories? And David said, Big Bird, I'm going to take care of the store. Mr. Hooper, he left it to me. And I'll make you your milkshakes, and we'll all tell you stories, and we'll make sure that you're okay. And Susan says, sure, we'll look after you. And Big Bird, shuffling away with his head down, says, well, it won't be the same. And Bob's voice, choked with real emotion, says, you're right, Big Bird. It'll never be the same around here without him. But you know something? We can all be very happy that we had a chance to be with him and to know him and to love him a lot when he was here. And Olivia said, and Big Bird, we still have our memories of him. And Big Bird said, yeah, our memories, memories. That's how I drew this picture, from memory. And we can remember him and remember him and remember him as much as we want to, but I don't like it. It makes me sad. And David said, we all feel sad, Big Bird. And Big Bird said one last time, he's never coming back. And David said, never. And Olivia said, no. And Big Bird, now a little angry, said, I don't understand. You know, everything was just fine. Why does it have to be this way? Give me one good reason. And Gordon says, Big Bird, it just has to be this way because. And Big Bird says, just because? And Gordon says, just because. Big Bird looks at his drawing. He says, you know, I'm going to miss you, Mr. Looper. And Maria, smiling as tears run from the corner of her eyes, says, that's Hooper, Big Bird, Hooper.
That was just beautiful, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking me to do it.
And I gather everybody on that set was in tears.
It was real emotion. What you see when you go to YouTube and call up this clip is very real. It was a year after, or most of a year after, Mr. Hooper had died, Will Lee, but they still missed him terribly because he was a father figure on that set. And John Stone was directing that day, and he wanted to do a second take, but the actor said, no, we can't do it again. So all in one take, a magnificent performance from Carol Spinney as Big Bird.
I should say. Well, Mr. Lee, who played Mr. Hooper,
yes,
died how?
He got an infection, and you know it too was a rampaging one, and he died at a New York hospital rather suddenly. But before he died, Bob McGrath went to see him in the hospital, and Will was neither drinking water nor passing water at that time, and they were very concerned about him, and Bob walked up to his hospital bed and looked at him and said, Will, if you promise that you'll urinate for the nurses, I promise you that the next episode will be sponsored by the letter P.
I love it. I love that story. And if you've just joined us, Michael Davis is here with me. His new book is titled Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. And let's go to the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Tara. You're on the air.
Good morning, Miss Diane. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
I cannot wait to read the book.
I'm so glad.
I'm 37, and I'm right smack in the middle of a huge brood. And we still talk about skits, and they're just as funny and witty as they were then, with Kermit the Frog being the reporter and the girl trying to figure out what the first name of Rumpelstiltskin is, and that cracks us up. But the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the little snippets in between the puppets, where they just had little clips, and the one that flashes back to me all the time is the kids and the grown-up trying to fly the kite. And how did they come up with those clips? Who found those? And, like, what made them put them in there? And they weren't, like, they were just little slices of life. It was no letters or numbers. It was just scenes.
Yes, those short action films were more than just interstitials to scotch tape segments together. They were very thoughtfully created. And Sesame Street brought in some of the greatest filmmakers in New York to do pieces. When it became a hit in 1969 and 70, the filmmakers began to come to CTW and say, may I make a film for Sesame Street? And which was extraordinary, of course. And, you know, her mentioning Kermit the Frog for Sesame Street News, you know, those comedy bits work on two levels. The children absolutely love them, but the adults got the joke. You know, here's Kermit doing a stand-up, right? And it was deliberate. From the very start, the producers wanted to have a bimodal audience. They wanted to have the kids, but they also wanted mom, dad, grandma,
right
babysitter,
there.
Right there. And the longitudinal research done by Sesame Workshop proves this out. Children learn so much more when there is an adult watching with them.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email who I'm not sure exactly what the name is here, but he or she says, I am 39. I was raised in a household that included lots of screaming and carrying on. I loved watching Sesame Street. It was a quiet place. No one yelled. Everyone was polite and kind and happy. Looking back, it was, for me, a place of respite in those chaotic days.
How lovely. How important that was for so many children. And I'd have to say that Fred Rogers provided the same kind of comfort to children all those years as well.
He really did. He taught children that everyone was important,
mm-hmm.
and everyone could learn from kindness.
Yes.
And courtesy.
Yes.
I loved Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. Let's go now to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Sharon.
Hi, I am 34, and I have a 9-month-old son now. I grew up on Sesame Street, and I am just amazed by his fascination with Elmo. And I didn't have Elmo as a kid, so I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about Elmo and the inspiration for Elmo, and I guess what his purpose was when he came to the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what, Oscar the Grouch, how he refers to Elmo, don't you? The Red Menace. You know, Elmo speaks almost directly to the 2-year-old. He is a projection of a 2-year-old child. He was created around the time that Sesame Street started to skew younger, that the audience that used to have a 4- and 5-year-olds were migrating to other shows in children's television. And now kids who are 4 and 5 think that Sesame Street is babyish. So that's one quick and easy explanation. I have to say that whenever you have a great character like Elmo, it's always a product of great writing and great performance. Kevin Clash has created Elmo, and he's the biggest rock star there is in children's television. And, you know, it's not easy. And Kevin Clash is great extemporaneously. He's very smart. He's very capable. And I always say that he's Jim Henson's brother from another mother. I mean, he's so much like Jim Henson, and yet he's a strapping 6'5" African-American man from Baltimore who grew up in Dundalk, Maryland. He is, like Henson, a producer, a director, a great talent. He trains puppeteers around the world. He's sort of continuing Jim Henson's legacy as much as anyone.
Michael Davis, the new book we're talking about is titled Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow at WAMU.org.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. Oh, cookie, cookie, cookie starts with C. Oh, C is for cookie. That's good enough for me. C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by NPR stations, by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why China has invested about $2 trillion in U.S. Treasury notes and other holdings, and what it would mean for our economy if China decided to sell. We talk with James Fallows, who's based in China. He's the national correspondent for The Atlantic and author of the new book, Postcards from Tomorrow's Square. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Michael Davis, there are a number of emails asking if there's a way to watch old Sesame Street episodes.
Well, I'm happy to tell you that there is. The folks at Sesame Workshop released two box sets. They call it Sesame Street Old School from the early days, and they're delightful compilations. And then the folks at Sesame Workshop also recently revamped their website, and they have loaded it with clips from Sesame Street. It's a joy to go there, and you can waste a lot of time for just going there and punching in names and punching in segments that you loved. And then also YouTube has a treasure trove of material. You know, my last year of working on this book was really when YouTube was really taking off. And every clip that I needed to see for my research, I could get at YouTube.
Interesting.
Every one of them.
I bet there are going to be a lot of hits this afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Let me bring you to another aspect of Sesame Street. This email from Liz, who says, I'm a 39-year-old mother of a 3- and 6-year-old, having been born in 1969. I literally grew up with Sesame Street and loved every minute of it. However, I do not allow my children to watch it. The show that I loved, she says, was replaced long ago with something less satisfying. The popular culture references are more in the moment than People magazine. They've also gone too far with incorporating social issues into the storyline. Television is not the best way to teach interpersonal skills. It doesn't allow for feedback or empathy.
There's a thoughtful mother for you, and it sounds like she really takes her role seriously as mom. And, you know, I applaud anyone who makes decisions about what their children should watch and monitor it. And, you know, it's okay to not like the current day Sesame Street. And, you know, if I would say if I were a father of preschoolers again, I loved being that in the early 80s. I certainly would want my children to watch Sesame Street still. I still think that it packs a powerful message. It's a wonderful way to excite the brain. And I really believe that Sesame Street helps to make not only children comedy literate, but culturally literate. Think about all the great guest stars, Yo-Yo Ma, Itzhak Perlman, Ray Charles. I mean, it's the most exclusive alumni association in show business.
At the same time, the audience for Sesame Street has become younger. Why is that?
Well, there's a good reason for it. And the reason is this is the golden age of preschool television. There has never been a period like this in quantity and quality where you could go to Nickelodeon and find a show like Wonder Pets, original operettas written for preschool children. It's a great show. There's great stuff on the Disney Channel for preschoolers, on Discovery Kids. And so right now, Sesame Workshop has tremendous competition for eyeballs and little eyeballs. And, you know, the show in the late 90s into the early 2000s began to skew younger. Kids who were 2 and 3 were watching the show more than kids who were a bit older. And so they tailored the show to make sure that they satisfied that younger audience. And they created Elmo's World for the last 15 minutes of the show. And, you know, some people thought it was a mistake to do so, you know, to make the show skew so young. But I think they did what they had to do, and Barney scared the bejeebers out of them. You know, do you remember when Barney was all the rage and the people at Sesame Workshop were scratching their heads saying, what's with this show and why are kids watching it and why is this such a phenomenon?
Well, it's interesting because Dr. Roseanne out in Walla Walla, Washington, said, I had a daughter who was born in 1989. She grew up watching Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers. She says, I remember when Barney came out, I was pretty floored by how dopey it was compared to Sesame Street. Sesame Street having very sophisticated humor, Barney being pretty much the opposite. I did everything I could to shield my daughter from Barney. I would fly by the channel and the channel changer with a purple and green flash and say, oh, look, here's Sesame Street. By the time my second child was born, Barney was everywhere. The stores were full of Barney character toys. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an issue I want to raise with you, okay, is the product production, that side of children's programming and the concerns that parents have that television for children is being used to promote sales.
I think that it is to a degree. In the case of Sesame Workshop, you know, at the very beginning, they were very wary of merchandising and licensing the characters for good reason, because the federal government paid for half of the $8 million that was used to create the show. And there were real tax implications to consider for a nonprofit as Children's Television Workshop was. But they very slowly began to introduce some products. And first it was books and records. And, you know, through the years, they've gotten into many different areas. And a lot of people, you know, kind of question it. And what they would tell you is that they use the proceeds from the revenues generated to help spread Sesame Street across the world. You know, it's in 140 different countries now, and most recently Northern Ireland. They had a big launch in India recently, and that's their aim these days at Sesame Workshop. They're really trying to turn. They are a global children's media company. They spend a little less time thinking about domestic television, much more about international television.
The issue you raised earlier about having parents with the children as they watch these programs is such an important one, not only for sorting out the somewhat sophisticated, subtle issues about relationships and death and birth. We haven't even talked about breastfeeding on children's television, which I think is marvelous.
And it was Buffy St. Marie.
But the issue of using children's television to babysit children instead of to educate children.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like the idea that television is a babysitter in many homes, and I know that it is. And all those years when I was writing about children's television for TV Guide, I was certainly aware of it. And I really took my job so seriously. I wanted to the best of my ability, to let parents know what was good out there. If children were going to sit and watch, at least let them watch something that's good. And, you know, there's more good than bad these days, I think, but there's a lot of bad out there, too. So, you know, I realize kids are going to watch. I just want them to watch good stuff.
Me too. Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah. Carrie, good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you. What a pleasure to be talking about Sesame Street.
Good.
I've listened to the show for a long time, and I've been moved by many topics, but I guess nothing is nearer or dearer to my heart than Sesame Street. What a fun thing it must have been to write this book and to do that research. It must have been just a constant joy.
Wow. It wasn't more than 20 minutes ago that I used those words to Diane between a break. I said that it was a labor of love, and I woke up every day working on this book with a smile on my face and eager to get to work. And if you're gonna write a book, let it be something that you feel passionately
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It takes a long time to write a book.
Yeah. The gestation period is quite long. And I'm eager to do another one, but I'm going to enjoy this moment where I can just sit in the chair and talk about Sesame Street.
Carrie, thanks for calling. And here's another view from Jim in Fort Lauderdale. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's a great show. You had me weeping with your recitation of that scene earlier. So
didn't he
that.
Do that beautifully? And, you know, I just want to make the comment. I asked Michael whether he had done that before. It was the very first time he had ever read that out loud.
It was marvelous.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that as a non-believer and as the father of a two-year-old, trying to raise a two-year-old in a very religious world, I'm incredibly grateful for the show's adamant agnosticism. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on how that developed, because it seems it's obviously a very clear choice, and just anything you have to say about that, because it's great for I'm just grateful for it.
Thanks for calling, Jim.
Well, they knew from the very beginning it would be a thicket if they did get involved in that, and they tried very hard with the writing staff and with the researchers to create that environment that where it never became an issue. They found a way, though, to talk about brotherhood, didn't they? And to talk about sharing and kindness and tolerance. And,
all those values.
Yeah,
they
come out of the good book, don't
exactly.
they? Yeah. So they did find a way.
We had an email from PJ who says she has a 44-year-old son with Down syndrome. Who benefited in immeasurable ways from the show and continues to enjoy and learn from it.
Yes. And, you know, I deal in the book with a young man named Jason Kingsley, born with Down syndrome, to Emily Kingsley, one of the great writers of Sesame Street. He made more than 50 appearances on the show. And Sesame Street was the very first show to feature a Down syndrome character. And, you know, that's one of the really cool things about Sesame Street. They interwove storylines with people with disability. It was totally seamless. You know, it didn't call a great deal of attention to itself. But Linda, the librarian who was deaf and was Bob's sweetheart, I mean, having her on the show was incredibly beneficial to people.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And then an email from Julie asking why there was no strong, quirky, interesting girl.
What a great question. And, you know, I tried to deal with it as best as I could in the book. And I will say this about Jim Henson. He loved working with and hanging with his friends. His friends were mostly males. They were all about the same size, about 6 foot, 6 foot one. And it wasn't a good old boys club, but they were like a bunch of fraternity guys together. They made each other laugh and they loved each other. And I think maybe they didn't want to bring in women to break up that little group. Okay, but they did. And certainly in recent years, some great female puppeteers have worked on Sesame Street. And I think of Stephanie DiBruzzo, who was the original Kate Monster in Avenue Q. She has been on Sesame Street. Fran Brill created Prairie Dawn and Zoe. But I do think, and I don't know how you feel about this caller, I do think that they have found their female superstar in Abby Cadabby, introduced two seasons ago.
Good. All right, and finally to Toby in Boonesboro, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane. Great show.
Thanks.
I can't wait to read the book. I was on Sesame Street as a young man. I was the original Barkley the dog.
Wow. How about that?
I thought you'd like to hear from Barkley.
How about that? How was your back, and did you suffer any injuries from being Barkley?
No, I didn't actually, although, you know, Barkley originally was going to be an ape, and they chose me. I had a friendship with Henson's from a church in Greenwich, Connecticut, and worked with their kids, and I was an acrobatic dancer. And they thought the character was going to be an ape and do cartwheels. And about halfway through developing the costume, the writers changed their mind and made a dog instead.
Could you talk for just a brief moment about how physically demanding it is to be a puppeteer for Jim Henson, for the company?
Well, I enjoyed it. I mean, I was in great shape. I was an athlete, a gymnast and dancer. I was taking class. So, no, it wasn't that hard, actually, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't easy. There were crutches on the front legs so that my arms would be as long as my legs. The funniest story was he didn't look like a dog for the first few days. We were like, how, you know, he just didn't look like a dog until I learned that dogs move from their rump, you know, and I had to start wiggling the butt.
How great. What a great
really
story.
Funny that day. We were all just laughing a hoot.
Oh, wow. Toby, I'm glad you called. Thank you so much. Finally, quick question for you, Michael. What was Sesame Street's role, do you believe, in preparing Americans to elect Barack Obama?
I think that for that part of the electorate aged 25 to 40, their first glimpse of a neighborhood of tolerance, a neighborhood where people with disabilities were woven seamlessly, a neighborhood where blacks and Latinas and whites and mixed and were neighbors, it was Sesame Street, and we can't calculate the power of that.
Michael Davis, his new book is titled Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Thank you so much. What a wonderful hour. I've enjoyed talking with you.
I've enjoyed it.
And your recitation, I'm telling you, you've just blown me away with that. And that was the very first time you did it.
Thanks.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio. How to get to Sesame Street. Come and play. Everything's A-OK. Friendly neighbors there, that's where we meet. Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?